Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Michael Pappas, Executive Director of the San Francisco Interfaith Council, and I'll be moderating today's panel discussion, which is convened in collaboration with Interfaith Power and Light and its Regeneration Project. We also welcome our listening audiences and invite everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. We are privileged to welcome representatives of the three Abrahamic faiths who will share with us their religious traditions' views about protecting the earth, caring for the environment, and being proactive in combating climate change, which many believe is the earth's greatest challenge. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished panelists. We have with us today the Reverend Canon Sally Bingham, an ordained priest of the Episcopal Church and executive director of Interfaith Power and Light and its Regeneration Project. Next to her is Rabbi Marvin Goodman, executive director of the Northern California Board of Rabbis, and Sumbul Ali Karamali, an attorney with degrees in English and Islamic law, who will, as Celia mentioned, be signing her book, The Muslim Next Door, after today's program. At this time, we'd invite our panelists to offer opening remarks before taking questions from the audience. For your convenience, we've provided audience question cards, which will be collected during the course of the program. We'll begin with Reverend Canon Sally Bingham, followed by Rabbi Goodman and Sumbul Ali Karamali. Sally?
Thank you, Michael. I'm going to stay in my chair, if that's all right.
That's just fine.
This always happens at occasions like this when somebody speaks before I do, and I find I have to comment on it. Stephen Nightingale's book, Granada, Pomegranate in the Hand of God, is absolutely remarkable book. It reads like a romantic novel, but it's actually fact. And he's a very close friend of mine. I married him to his wife, Lucy, and I baptized their daughter, Gabriella, who is one of the stars of the book of Granada. So that was fun to have you mention that. And then one correction, Michael. I am not the executive director of Interfaith Power and Light. The executive director is sitting in the audience right in the middle of the row back there. Susan Stevenson is the executive director. I actually am the founder and the president.
Fair enough.
That's just to make some clarity. One of the first things that we were asked to do today in our remarks to all of you was to say and point out how our faith, and in my case, Christian faith, draws attention to taking care of the environment. Well, Interfaith Power and Light actually started not because we saw climate change as a moral and important issue, but largely because I was sitting in a pew in an Episcopal church in 1995 praying for a reverence for the earth and saying that I love my neighbor, which is one of the first, it's the first and great commandment to love God and love your neighbor. And I am a trustee on the board of directors of Environmental Defense Fund, and I have been for 25 years. At EDF board meetings, scientists come in, economists come in, and they give us really detailed factual information on what humans are doing to the planet. And I'm sitting in the church on a Sunday, and I'm praying for a reverence for the earth. I'm saying I love my neighbor, and I thought, there seems to be a disconnect between what we as Christians say we believe in and how we're actually behaving. Because think back to the 70s and 80s, some of the environmental organizations were already talking about climate change and how it was affecting crops and weather and disease and trees and oceans. So I thought, how can we, as people of faith, sit in a pew and profess a love for God and our neighbors and continue to pollute our neighbor's air and water and throw trash out the windows? And really, that is the beginning of my whole ministry, to help people in pews, and at that time, mostly Episcopalians, to understand that we were hypocrites. And that's really been the basis and why Interfaith Power and Light began. And at EDF and in other places around the country and organizations, in the early 90s, people were beginning to talk about climate change and the ill effect it has on all of the planet. So the Regeneration Project, which is the founding organization and the 501c3, we took on Interfaith Power and Light as a campaign with the idea that we would inform and give as much information as we could, using science as the background, to people in the pews about how climate was really harming all of God's creation. And if we're called as people of faith, which I'm sure Marv's going to tell you too, God put Adam in the garden to till it and to keep it. We are the gardeners of this planet. And I don't think that a person can say they're Christian and then not be an environmentalist. And some people ask me, did you come to this because you're an environmentalist? Where and why did you get involved in this? And it was my faith that started the program. I mean, it's my saying I was a Christian, sitting in a pew, professing a love for God, and then feeling very hypocritical to not be trying to save creation. I could not stand back or watch other people stand back or sit back and destroy creation. I mean, to me, it just was sinful. And early on, I was introduced to the Ecumenical Patriarch Bartholomew, who runs the big 50 million Orthodox Church, Greek Orthodox Church, and was invited to go out on an ocean voyage with him, where I met other religious leaders and scientists and journalists all talking about the same issue. And this has been, it's not something new for the Christian Church, even when we had the great fortune of having Pope Francis here last summer, but we also learned that their popes before Pope Francis have talked about creation care and protection of the environment. It just happens that at this point in time, it's becoming very clear to people that we're almost gone too far on the destruction that we're causing to the world, to the planet. And because climate change is an overarching issue that's affecting all of our things, health, as I mentioned, it's oceans. And of course, the oceans are in dire straits with the acidification coming from too much carbon dioxide. So I really believe that you have to, if you consider yourself a Christian, then you should be, I think, a very active environmentalist and an advocate, talking to others, spreading the word. You know, Jesus said, people will know you by your love. Jesus also said that what you do to the least of us, you do to me. Well, who is the most grievously affected by climate change are the poor people. And if we're called to serve the poor, which in fact we are, and every mainstream religion is called to serve the poor. So we have a responsibility as Christians, I think all people of faith, but even particularly for Christians, because we had all these little mandates coming in from Jesus about loving your neighbor, and loving someone does not allow you to destroy their air, their water, their health. And when you think that we in the industrialized world have contributed really more than most, well, now China is outdoing us with carbon emissions, but the United States for a long time polluted the air around the world, put too much carbon dioxide, and the people that are suffering the most in the developing world are the least able to adapt and live with the consequences of what we have done in America and now China is doing. And that to me makes it an immoral and a justice issue, that why should the people who contributed the least to the problem be the ones that are suffering the most with no ability to adapt or to come up with the renewable solution? So I'm a big advocate for those of us who care helping the folks in the developing world, as well as right here. I mean, here in the U.S., our coal plants, the refineries, the cement factories are nearly always in poor neighborhoods. So the people that are who really don't have much of a voice in politics are the ones that are being affected the most. And it's our job as people of faith to help those folks and to always have it in our minds that everything that we do, our behavior affects our neighbors. Now, if you're someone, if you're Christian and you say you love your neighbor, understand that every one of your behaviors, whether it's the coffee you drink, the clothes you wear, the car you drive, the electricity you use, every single one of those things affects your neighbor. And if all of us could remember that when you turn on the light switch, when you start your car, somebody else is being affected by this behavior. And if we all had that in our minds, my behavior counts, I matter. I matter to my neighbors, I matter to God. And I'm here to be a steward of this creation. And I think that there's no stronger mandate for environmental stewardship than love God and love your neighbor. And all Christians have that in their foundation.
Wonderful. We would encourage you, we've gotten some wonderful questions, but if you have any burning questions as you're listening to this as well, I would also invite the panelists to be listening to one another, and if you have any burning questions to ask one another, that there will be opportunity after the opening statements. Rabbi Marv.
You said burning questions. I think we should use a different word than burning these days.
This is fair enough.
When I began to think about these remarks, one of the thoughts that came to my mind was what Abraham Joshua Heschel, a great 20th century theologian and philosopher, said. He said, as civilization advances, the sense of wonder almost necessarily declines. Such decline is an alarming symptom of our state of mind. And he goes on to say, mankind will not perish for want of information, but only for want of appreciation. The beginning of happiness lies in the understanding that life without wonder is not worth living. What we lack, he said, is not a will to believe, but a will to wonder. I think wonder is one of the elements that we need to keep in mind as we think about this wonderful, unique world in which we live. I believe that Judaism's perspective on these issues of caring for the environment and being proactive combating climate change, the two issues we were sort of asked to talk about, reflect upon today first and foremost. It comes from the first two chapters of the book of Genesis. Relative to the environment and climate change, these two chapters in Genesis contain teachings that are so simple and yet they're so profound. They truly have a tremendous amount of relationship for relevance for us and for our world. Consider the statement that God makes to Adam and Eve after he creates them. God blesses them and says, be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth, subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the sky and over every living thing that moves on the earth. God gives us life, and God gives us the world to have dominion over. But what's not clear is what it means for humans to subdue the earth and have dominion over creation. So the first question I think about when I think about this is how we might understand what God told Adam and Eve, and how might that enable our understanding of this critical moment we're at in history, and how we might be called upon to act. While on the surface the words of these verses appear to give people license to degrade and subdue the earth, the oral rabbinic tradition that over centuries has evolved and deepened our understanding of the Torah and what it seems to be saying makes clear that a wholly different message is being conveyed. Let me give you a couple examples of what that message might be. The Midrash, part of that oral tradition, teaches that one rabbi said, if he, the human being, merits the earth, then God says, have dominion. While if he does not merit it, then God says, he, the human being, will be taken down. This teaching links human dominion over creation to humanity's righteousness. If humanity has merit through its righteousness, it can rule over nature. If it does not, it does not have the right to rule over nation, over nature. And in fact, humanity will descend and not be granted dominion over nature. So you might be wondering, how shall or might we understand this kind of righteousness? Another midrash gives us insight into this. And realize that this was written over 1,000 years before we began to think about climate change and the environment. It makes clear that part of human righteousness involves being stewards of the earth. The Midrash says that God showed Adam around the garden and said, "Look at my works. See how beautiful they are, how excellent they are. For your sake, I created them. See to it that you do not spoil and destroy my world. For if you do, there will be no one to repair it." Amazing statement, again said, more than 1,000 years ago. Acting righteously, the Midrash seems to be saying to us, involves treating the world with utmost respect. And if we act thusly, for this humanity will merit dominion over creation. Another imperative I understand from these chapters comes from what they teach us about our relationship to the land, to the earth, the literal land. And we learn this from paying close attention to language in the Torah, a frequent way that the rabbis interpret the Torah, what it might mean. With respect to this, I was reminded that what the Pope said in his encyclical about our origin from dust. His comment made me stop and think and be reminded that in Hebrew, the word for the ground, the earth, the essence, the dust, is Adama. And quite amazingly, what the first man is called in Hebrew is Adam. They come from the same root. Our connection to the world, to the earth, to the land is obvious. Sadly, too many of us, even if we think about this language connection occasionally, that the relationship between people and the earth is explicit in the Torah, too many of us turn away from this important lesson of interconnectedness. We're interconnected with the earth, yet too many of us forget this when we're living out our lives. Another lesson Judaism teaches about the climate crisis comes from the beautiful concept in the Torah, in our tradition, called the sabbatical year. Although the scale of the problems brought on by climate change were unimaginable in the time of the Torah, the sabbatical year, as it's articulated in the Torah, addresses certain maladies of human society that have not gone away and that now threaten us with self-destruction. As in ancient time, these maladies include self-interest, short-term thinking, and unsustainable exploitation of people and the earth, all which danger our existence. There are important lessons we can learn and we must learn from the sabbatical year. The sabbatical year challenges us to acknowledge that human existence depends on our relationship with the earth. In ancient times, almost everyone was a farmer. Agriculture depleted the land, so it had to be kept, in a manner of speaking, under control. Consequently, the sabbatical year for the land to rest. Today, few of us are farmers, so we need to rethink the meaning of the sabbatical year for us today. Consider this. Today, we are all dependent on energy, and our energy is unsustainable. Our system of energy is unsustainable. The mining and the burning of fossil fuels is poisoning fresh water, acidifying the ocean, warming the atmosphere, and disrupting the climate. Putting a complete stop to this destructive system seems impossible, just as it must have seemed impossible for ancestors to stop planting for that sabbatical year. The concept of the sabbatical year challenges us to look beyond the short-term hardship and imagine the future we can create if we act boldly to right this wrong. Finally, the sabbatical year sets a deadline for action. In ancient time, when the seventh year arrived, it had to be observed. Today, the sabbatical year teaches us that we cannot delay taking action until it's convenient or until we're convinced that there is no other choice. Fulfilling our ethical responsibility is not optional. Even if it seems imprudent or extreme, we must rededicate ourselves to building a sustainable society in harmony with the earth. I guess the question we ultimately need to face, is who is willing to act on these kinds of issues and imperatives? When I think about this question, I'm once again reminded of the impact the Pope had on us just a year ago. Hearing him speak to Congress and reading the words of the encyclical got me thinking and wondering what it is we might do to carry his message to the hearts of those who have not yet heard those words and allowed them to touch their hearts. I wondered to myself, how many people heard him speak to Congress? How many read the encyclical? And I answered myself with the realization that without a doubt, not enough. I also said to myself that in my opinion, a key issue moving forward is to find a way to keep alive the messages this man brought to the attention of the world. It was clear from listening to the Pope that he's a realist in terms of what he thinks we can or cannot expect of our political leaders. With regards to ecology, there's no way they are ready to do that which is necessary, that which we know they need to do. So what I think we need to do is to make the voices of the religious and interfaith community so loud and so continuous that politicians will be forced to listen and forced to respond. And the only way to make our voices loud enough is to have this effort be a grassroots-based effort. I believe this is the only way our message will be heard. It's the only way changes will happen.
Thank you. Simple. The floor is yours.
Okay. thank you, both of you. So Islam is the newest of our three religions, but it accepts, for those of you who don't know, Judaism and Christianity within itself, its own tradition. So Muhammad, who was the prophet of Islam, considered himself to be preaching the religion of Abraham. He didn't see himself as preaching a new religion, at least at first. He saw himself as preaching the religion of the one God. So I want to tell you just a little bit about, just explain Islamic religious texts first, because without that it'd be hard to explain what Islam says about the environment. So, excuse me, Muslims believe that, well, the Quran is the Muslim holy text, and Muslims believe that God sent down words to the angel Gabriel, who brought them to Prophet Muhammad, who spoke them out loud. His followers wrote down the words that he spoke out loud, and these words were compiled into one book within 20 years of the Prophet Muhammad's death. And this compilation is called the Quran. So it was compiled in the 7th century. I was telling a friend of mine who is from Mexico and Catholic, and she said, "The same angel Gabriel?" So yes, the same angel Gabriel in the Judeo-Christian tradition. So Muslims believe. So since the Quran was compiled, not a word of it has been changed, because since Muslims believe it's the word of God, you can't just go changing the word of God if you feel like it. So the Quran that's printed now has the same words as the Quran that was compiled in the 7th century at the very beginning. So the Quran doesn't change. It's considered infallible, although our interpretations of the Quran can change. Now, so that is the primary source of Islam. The source, almost as important, is the words and deeds of the Prophet Muhammad. So we have a record of these, and we look to those. So for the early Muslims, the Quran and the words and deeds of the Prophet Muhammad were not necessarily enough to cover every situation that they wanted answers about. So they started interpreting the Quran and the Sunnah and coming up with a whole body of interpretive literature, very much like the Talmud, a whole body of interpretive literature that explained and analogized the religious texts. And this body of literature is not a set of rigid rules, but it's a body of arguments and debates and theoretical exercises and opinions about what the religious rules should be. So that's to give you an overview. That's called fiqh, by the way. That religious literature is called fiqh. Sharia, which is a whole other topic, but Essentially, it's an abstract concept that just means the way of God. Literally, it actually means the source of water or the road to the watering place. So water has a very central symbolism in Islam. So going back to the Quran, the environment and nature is actually one of the eight main themes of the Quran. The Quran has 6,236 verses, and over 750 of them talk about nature. Usually in the context of nature and creation being a sign of the power and knowledge and existence of God. That is the context in which nature is discussed. But there's a very specific verse that also says the Quran has made human beings vice regents or trustees on earth. So as such, human beings are supposed to channel God's divine mercy into taking care, into being vice regents or trustees, sometimes called stewards, of the earth. The Prophet Muhammad famously said, "The earth is green and beautiful, and God has appointed you stewards over it." Very specific. Also, the Islamic texts are filled with injunctions to not waste resources and to take care of resources, and this extends to animals as well. So Islamic texts contain numerous rules about the rights of animals, how they have the right to life, food, water, home, medicine, etc. So this all happened, you know, in the early centuries. So from like this, the 7th century is the Quran, the Prophet is the 7th century, maybe the 7th to the 10th centuries are the fiqh was being developed. So this was before there was an awareness that there was a threat to the environment. So even before that, there were very specific injunctions. So the Quran says to God belong all beings in the heavens and on earth. And it talks about, stewardship is called khalifa, and the Quran talks about how human beings have to be stewards, and it talks about people who have violated this stewardship. One verse says, corruption has appeared on land and in the sea as an outcome of what human hands have wrought. So there the Quran is talking about how there's already, we're like 7th century, there's already corruption in the land and the sea because of what human beings have done. The Quran says, servants of God are those who walk gently upon the earth. So, you know, for some Muslims, walking gently upon the earth means being vegan because that has the least environmental impact. The Quran says, harvest fruits and vegetables, but give the poor their due on harvest day and do not waste, for God does not love the wasteful. It's very hard in today's factory farming times to, you know, I mean, where's the harvest that's giving part of it to the poor? Actually, I have to say, I'm on the board of Hidden Villa, which is an organization in Los Altos Hills, which whose mission is environmental education and multicultural education. And they have a community-supported agriculture program. And every year they give a quarter of whatever produce they grow to the Community Services Agency of Mountain View so that underprivileged, underserved communities can have organic, fresh produce. So that's what the Quran is actually anticipating when they're saying, harvest your vegetables, but give the poor their due. And then also there's one of the themes is justice in the Quran, and justice applies to the environment as well. So very similar to what Sally and Marv were saying, Muslims are not supposed to eat if their neighbor is hungry. The Prophet Muhammad said, when you see one who has more, look to one who has less. So as Sally said, all religions talk about equity and helping the poor and helping people who don't have enough. As far as the environment and justice, the Prophet said that he who cuts down a tree arbitrarily with no reason will answer to God in the afterlife. So there is a sense of justice applying to the environment as well. And then animals, finally, animals, it's very clear in the religious texts that animals may not be tortured. Even in medieval times, in Muslim lands, there were animal hospitals and endowments for taking care of sick and incapacitated horses and donkeys. Maybe you guys have heard of halal, but halal means permissible. So halal butchering was developed, the rules for halal butchering were developed to for the purposes of compassion and health. So halal means that an animal has to be first said a prayer over to show that you're eating it for food, because there's no hunting that's allowed in Islam. So you have to show that you're hunting, that you're killing it for food. You have to take the sharpest knife available and kill it in the most merciful manner, let the blood drain out, and you have to kill it outside of the presence of other animals. So that is halal butchering, and you may not mistreat animals. So again, for increasing amount of Muslims now, family farming methods are not acceptable in Islam because they mistreat animals. And so I wanted to give you an example just to put things in perspective. You've all heard of jihad. You know, jihad is another topic that I won't talk about in detail, but jihad actually means struggle. It means the greater jihad is an internal struggle. Military jihad can only be undertaken in self-defense or to overthrow an oppressor. So in the media, when you hear jihadi as synonymous with terrorist, that's not true. Terrorism is against Islam. But anyway, so even if you have, even if you're conducting war in self-defense or to overthrow an oppressor, there are very strict rules of engagement. And so what's very telling is, in addition to the ban on killing anyone who is not a combatant, you can't kill civilians, you can't kill non-combatants, also you may not cut down any trees, you may not destroy vegetation, you may not poison the water supply, you may not destroy crops, and you may not harm animals. And this is in the extreme situation of warfare. Like, even in warfare, you can't do that. So when you hear of ISIS and Al-Qaeda, you know, destroying all this property and killing people who are civilians, I mean, that's totally outside what is allowable. So in terms of the religious text, it's very clear that that trees and the natural environment are God's creation, and you have to take care of it. Also, you know, during Ramadan, Muslims fast for 30 days from dawn to sunset, and there's no food or water that's allowed. And people often ask me, okay, I understand you're not eating, but why aren't you drinking? You know, why don't you have any water? And it's because not everyone has clean water. And it's to impress upon us how important water is and how much we need to take care of it. So the Prophet, actually, there's a quote from the Prophet that's very famous. It says, even if you are standing next to a flowing river, do not waste water. And actually, there's a story in Islam about a prostitute and how her sins were actually washed away completely because she gave water to a thirsty dog. Okay, so I think I can talk. I don't know how I'm doing on time, but there are, the one thing that struck me about when I was looking at all of this stuff, the one thing that struck me is that even though religion is not a science, it's not a hard science, it's open to interpretation, there is no argument about this stuff in Islam. I mean, it's so clear that in Islam, in Muslim circles, there's no argument that we have to take care of the environment and that we're trustees for the environment and that we have to take combat climate change. I mean, it's very, nobody's arguing with it. I mean, on aspects of religion, people always argue, right? but in this one, there's very little argument. Last year, there was published an Islamic climate declaration, which was signed by Muslim religious leaders as well as Muslim environmental leaders, and which said that all 1.6 billion Muslims have a religious responsibility to combat climate change. And it called upon the countries of the world to phase out fossil fuels and by 2050. So it was a big thing. So
thank you. We want to thank all of our distinguished panelists for their informative comments. And now it's time for questions. And we have collected a lot of questions, and more are on their way. This one is interesting because you've spoken about stewardship of the environment from your own traditions' perspectives. This person is asking the question, what has each of the panelists personally done to contribute to reduce pollution of the environment?
I'll take that.
Okay.
Well, then,
Exactly.
Well, I drive an all-electric car. I have a compost in my backyard.
I never get even in my electric car to go to the grocery store. I walk, and I have Pacific Gas and Electric sends out every quarter how your house is doing, what the comparable ones are. I am in the excellent or the good category for the amount of energy I use, and I preach and teach and help others understand that we matter and our behavior matters and we need to cut our carbon emissions.
And if I may, because a good part of the work of Interfaith Power and Light is also helping congregations, which are houses of worship, to be environmentally conscious and responsible too. Is that
absolutely
not the case?
And there are 650 congregations in the state of California who have joined the Interfaith Power and Light program. And I neglected to say, but I think it probably is understood, that Interfaith Power and Light is a religious response to global warming. That's the tagline. And our congregations here in California are exemplary. They're putting in energy efficient technology. They are the sensors in bathrooms to keep the lights out. They are preaching and teaching others in the church community that they need to go home and make changes in their own homes. And so, I mean, I'm doing really, I think, as much as I can. And also I want to add that I'm not driving a Tesla. My smart car is a smart.
Okay. And I just wanted to mention here, one of the questions was climate change. The correct term is global warming.
That is correct.
Unless you're a Republican.
So I don't drive an electric car. I only drive a Prius C. But this current tank of gas, I always check. I'm one of those people who, if you're driving behind, you're yelling at them because they're driving at just the right mileage to keep it in the green zone. So I'm this last tank of gas, I'm getting 57 miles of the gallon. Susan and I, we're friends. We're not connected. In each of our houses, we had solar put on the house. We live in places that have enough sun, not like San Francisco. I work with CIPL as a member of their steering committee, and I was talking with Susan before the executive director that what I would like to start doing is, maybe it's because I'm getting older, is I talked about the voice of the interfaith community. I think we need to yell a little bit more when California is afraid, or the legislature is potentially not going to vote on a bill because they... it might not pass. To me, a very important bill, AB 30, SB or AB?
AB.
SB.
SB 32. SB. I think we ought to make them vote. We ought to know who's, so to speak, with us and who's against us. And I think that, so one of the things I want to do is I want to, as I say, I'm getting older, I'm getting a little more impatient, I want to scream a little bit more. So I think that's something that I do that I hope you'll do as well.
Symbol?
Yeah, I'm all for screaming. and I drive an electric car and a Prius. but
not at the same time.
Not at the same time. and actually, I have to say, I am a total convert to using buckets in the house. I have buckets all over the house, because it's amazing how much water you can save. So all of my plants are watered with reclaimed water, not fresh water. My fountain runs on reclaimed water, like shower runoff. And I'm also on the, as I said, the board of Hidden Villa, which is an environmental education organization in Los Altos Hills, and also on the advisory board of Actera, which also has extensive environmental education programs for people trying to learn about how to decrease their footprint. Listening to you guys, I feel envious because your congregations and your communities sound so organized. And there's a joke that that this guy says, "Oh, I don't belong to any organized religion." And a Muslim says, "Oh, become Muslim because we're the most disorganized religion you've ever come across." and part of that is because we don't have any kind of real structure in our religion. And part of it is because a lot of the Muslims in the U.S. are immigrants, fairly recent immigrants, one or two generations ago. And so they haven't really had a chance to get organized. They're just doing that now. And then also, Muslims in America are the most diverse racially and culturally religious group in the country. And that's, although that's wonderful, it presents challenges as well, because that means that, you know, everybody comes with their own cultural baggage. If you're a Muslim from a small town in Libya, you have a different outlook from if you're a Muslim from New Delhi. And then there's the language barrier. So there's been a lot of, it's taken time to even get the African-American Muslim community together with the immigrant Muslim community. So we have a lot of sort of logistical issues that are involved. Generally speaking, in the U.S., it's really amazing how many initiatives there are that Muslims are undertaking. There are like D.C. Green Muslims, like one of the big mosque in Washington, D.C. publishes a big paper on how to decrease your environmental impact. In California, we know Muslim venture capitalists who support ventures that are funding green technology. My husband, who's here, has a client who is trying to replace the dirty energy plants in Pakistan with clean energy. So there's a lot that's happening, and it's very exciting. It's an exciting time.
Okay. I'd like to stick with this because the rabbi brought it up. This person says, I'm a member of the climate mobilization. We believe that it's now time to talk about climate emergency and not climate change. First, they asked, do you agree? And how do you think we can have the most impact to get our political leaders to respond with action? I selected this question because I know that in your DNA, Sally, you're a lobbyist in some ways. And if you could tell us what's going on in Sacramento and what you've recently been up to, and also how, Rabbi Marv, how loud do you want to yell? And, mm-hmm. And Symbol, you can pick up on it next. Thank you.
Well, that's a big question.
It's a big question. And what happened in Sacramento?
Well, and that would be taking that question down to local activity, mm-hmm. though, and talking about what's happening in California. And this, in a way, responds to what you're saying about they need to vote no matter what. Yes and no. SB 32 is a bill that's going through the California legislation right now. And it's a follow-on to AB 32, which is the Global Warming Solution Act that Governor Schwarzenegger signed. And it had we need to reduce our emissions by so much by 2020. What's happening now is Fran Pavley has written a bill that wants to extend that length of time from 2020 to 2030. And this is what they're all talking about. The oil and gas lobbyists are so heavily involved in not having that happen that, and you know, it's back to following the money. A lot of these legislatures get money from the oil industry. So it's difficult. And Governor Brown, whose office we visited last week, does not want to lose another bill. Climate change has become his legacy for the state of California. And California is leading the world on climate emission reductions. They're doing a cap and trade in China now, and everybody's watching. And the AB 32 bill has been extremely successful. We have cut emissions. We have giving 25% of the money that comes from buying the credits to back to the faith community, and some of it's going into more research and development. Now, there was a bill last year, 350, and I don't remember whether that's a, Susan knows all this far better than I do, but it failed by something like 4 or 5 votes. So the governor does not want that to happen with SB 32, this one that's going through now, and he'll pull the bill if they don't have the votes. And apparently there are 4 or 5 votes that they need to be assured that this effort will pass. And but the good news is that California is doing a really good job on cutting emissions, and it's showing that tremendous number of jobs have been created through the work with renewable energy. There are more people working in solar now across the country than in the oil or coal business, and that's that we've done that here in California, and so how loud should we scream? We should be screaming, but yeah. I'm gonna let you answer that one.
How loud can you scream?
You what?
How loud can you scream?
I'm not sure. I think my inclination to scream more is probably a result of having my first grandchild born 5 months ago. Yeah, I want to have a world that he's going to grow up in. That's going to be a world in which he and others can live. And I'm fearful that we're creating the justice system that we're creating for all kinds of people is something that we're just not willing to fight hard enough to change. I was at a meeting this past week or a week or so ago with Michael ran with the chief of police, the acting chief of police, and Reverend Amos Brown made a comment then during the meeting about paralysis by analysis, which he had said, I had heard him say many, many times, but it really struck me that we are at a time where there's so much talk and so little action. I've got, what have I got to lose? You know, if nothing else, I can always say I'm close to retirement. You know, if I upset people, you know, let them tell me. You know, you're not the board of rabbis or the rabbi in residence of Federation, Jewish Federation. You're not in charge anymore. You know, I think that there really needs to be some. I understand what the governor's doing, but I feel like, and I'm going to take my direction from Sally and Susan because I'm on. I work with them, but I really think there needs to be some accountability. That it's time to stop letting people get off without saying how they would vote, I know obviously we can't get them to sign I'm going to vote against something because that would just be stupid on their part. But there needs to be some way that there has to be some accountability so that we can take this problem, take this concern, take this crisis, and do something with it. Otherwise, we're going to be, you know, there's a few young people here. You're going to be stuck with a world that we created that's going to be unlivable. Or at least the people in certain parts of the world, it's going to be unlivable for them. You know, we'll have our air conditioning when it gets hot. You know, as we talk about the Olympics, and this I'll end, one of the things I read in the paper recently was that in, I think, 70 years or 50 years, that there are only going to be, the way we're going, there's only going to be three cities in North America that would be have the right climate for the Olympics to be held: San Francisco, Vancouver, and some other city, because all the other cities will be too hot in the summertime.
Just, Sumbul, if you could talk about advocacy in an Islamic context and tie it into this issue of environmental responsibility, that'd be great. Thanks.
Okay. So sometimes trying to advocate for the environment, it feels like, you know, what can I do? I'm just one person, and how can I make a difference? And these people in Washington are not listening to me anyway. That's a really familiar feeling to a Muslim, because you know, nobody listens to Muslims either. We're all trying to find our voice. But the good thing is that there have finally been organizations that are popping up for advocacy, not like the Council on American Islamic Relations is advocacy for Muslims in terms of civil rights, but you know, they're expanding to cover things like climate change as well, and or global warming. And there's also another organization, fairly new, that's I think it's called the Islamic Foundation for Ecology and the Environment, and they are the ones who came up with this big statement that was signed by a lot of people. And one of the things that they say, which I think is absolutely crucial, is that interfaith partnerships are really important, because it's not enough for just us separately to do stuff. You know, we need to partner. I mean, global warming is going to affect all of us, no matter what our religion or lack of religion, right? So we have to get together and form partnerships so that we can have a bigger voice. And I think that's starting to happen. The cyclical by the Pope, I mean, that the Pope responded to the Islamic Climate Declaration, which was really wonderful. So that was a first step, and I think that's where we have to pursue.
Excellent. We'd like to remind our internet and listening audiences that this is a program of the Commonwealth Club of California addressing interfaith ecological stewardship and responsibility with the Reverend Canon Sally Bingham, Rabbi Marvin Goodman, and Sumbul Ali Karamali. I'm Michael Pappas, moderator for today's presentations. The next question says, it appears you all believe in the science of climate change or global warming. Do you all believe in evolution or the literal story of Genesis?
I can go.
Thank you.
Okay. So, so Islam, as I said, accepts Judaism and Christianity. So we do have the creation story as well. It's not very specific. So the Quran is not a narrative. It's not a story. It's actually unmetered verse. So it's poetry, if it's anything. And it, if you read it as if it's a series of divine messages, then it's easier to make sense of. So it has the creation story, but it's not very specific. And it also it has enough other information. Like it says, the time doesn't pass for God the way it passes for you. So just because it's 1,000 years for you, it might be a day for God, right? So it, there's a sense of, you know, just what you're reading in the Quran, you know, there's more to it than that. So I think evolution, I'd take it for granted. I mean, I don't think the Quran, I don't see a contradiction between evolution and what the Quran says. You know, Muslims, we have to, God made people, but it doesn't say exactly how people were made. And I think there's a lot of leeway in that. I have a friend who's a PhD in biology, and, you know, she's a devout Muslim, and of course she believes in evolution. She has a PhD in biology. She doesn't see any contradiction. So if you look at the polls of American Muslims, they're kind of just right there in line with all the other faith communities in terms of how many percentages believe in evolution and how many don't.
And I definitely believe in evolution. And I don't think there's any contradiction between Christianity and evolution. And I always say that we wouldn't have a prayer without the science. And the science, and when you ask religious leaders to be in a pulpit talking about climate change, and let me just say one thing about global warming, climate change. Global warming is more or less the scientific explanation, but global warming is causing the climate to change. And it's really okay. They're interchangeable, those two things. They're being used by all the different communities interchangeably. But in terms of the science, they didn't have science when they were trying to figure out. They didn't have the institution of science when people were trying to figure out what was God's purpose for putting humans on the planet in the first place. And it also, all of the scripture that says the world was created in 7 days was written years and years and years after we got here. And it was folks trying, I was taught in seminary that the Bible is, and probably the Quran as well, really not meant to be taken literally. It is humans' attempt to understand our purpose on the earth, and that these are suggestions on how to live your life, that the Bible is a metaphor. It is not to be taken literally. Now, having said that, there are lots of people in the very Bible literalist community who do take it literally and then Ron don't too. Accept evolution. And so that's where there's the rub. But there are fewer and fewer of those folks, even though Texas is now taking evolution. They're saying that evolution is a theory in the textbooks for children's public school in the state of Texas, which is, it's too bad. It's sort of going backwards in time. But most mainstream religions, and here we have Jews and Muslims and Christians represented here, are believers in science. You know, we're beyond where, I mean, the Catholic Church put Galileo in prison, and they've made mistakes over the years, but I believe we're moving along a more progressive attitude towards evolution.
Two Jews, three opinions. So there are there are people who believe in evolution. There are people who don't. I believe that the stories in the Bible, the Torah and the Bible, and the tradition is teaching truth, not necessarily true stories, but the stories, whether it's the creation, whether it's Noah, whether it's Abraham, or all that happened to Moses and in the Exodus, it is truth for us to learn from and to share.
Thank you. Sambul, you touched on this in your opening remarks, but I think it would be great to also hear from your colleagues as well. Why do the Abrahamic faiths ignore that eating meat is very destructive, not only to God's creatures, but to the environment?
Well, I think, you know, at least for Islam, it was born in the Arabian Peninsula, which is mostly desert. So it was a nomadic, a lot of it was a nomadic community. And so they pretty much had to eat meat to survive. There wasn't a lot of agriculture going on there. But there were, you know, rules that came down, like you're not supposed to, all sorts of rules that we don't think about now, but, you know, you can't eat a carrion, you can't eat blood, you can't eat anything with fangs. So we've been trying to figure out whether eels have fangs lately. But anyway, so it was, I think it was a necessity, whereas now there are so many other options. You know, we are so lucky to have so many choices in terms of food. So there is I happen to be vegan myself, but there is a movement to say, oh, you know, we can have the most individual impact if we are vegetarian or vegan, even more so. So my brother became vegan 20 years ago, and people still didn't even know what it was, right? It was very difficult for him to find food, and now there's been huge progress in 20 years. It's a lot easier now.
Okay. Before the tradition is in Judaism, before the flood, the Noah flood, everybody was a vegetarian, and that as after the what happened to the flood and the trauma that it created, that God allowed people to eat meat, or God said people could eat meat, but it had to be in some ways very very much like the like halal kashrut is. Being concerned about the animals, being concerned about the blood, which mm-hmm. is the life of an animal, which animals, which can be, which can't be. The whole premise of kashrut is to be conscious of what it is we put in our mouths. As a result of what being conscious of that, we limit ourselves in terms of what we eat, how we eat, and we say prayers before as well as after. To be, again, just to maintain our consciousness of the privilege we have to eat, to have food.
Well, the beginning, when you read that question out, you said, why have our religions ignored this issue? I don't think we have ignored it by any means. It's very, very controversial. It's like talking about population control. And for religious groups to push for some particular, well, particularly around things like population and eating meat, is very, very difficult. But our people on our staff at CIPL and around the country are very often vegetarians. Most of my friends are giving up eating red meat on a regular basis. I only eat red meat if somebody serves it to me. But I wouldn't be considered a vegan. But don't think that subject is being ignored. We're all struggling with it. We're trying to figure out how to address this, because that the cruelty and the way the industrial agriculture treat animals is just horrendous. And I think that all you have to do is see a few of these films that are out on mm-hmm. the way the animals are treated, and you'll never eat another bite of meat.
My son-in-law is applying for a job to be a chef at a company that is making vegan meat, stuff that tastes like meat, and a Stanford scientist is in the process of doing this. So the hope is that we can get away from having if it tastes like it and you get the sensation and the pleasure, that we can get away from the methane and all the stuff that, that cows and farming do.
Is it going to bleed?
I don't know if it's going to bleed, but it's going to have that kind of taste, supposedly. Yeah.
Oh, and by the way, I just want to say, when I was growing up, my mom used to buy kosher meat because halal butchers were nowhere to be found, so that's what we ate.
Yeah. And, you know, having grown up and been raised in the Orthodox Christian faith, I know that during fast periods that there's a total abstinence of meat, dairy products, fish, wine, and oil for over 40 days. And it's a cleansing, but it's also a reminder that your dependency is not on those things, but on God. So I think that that's also a reminder that that it hasn't been ignored, but we just have to rediscover, I think. Unfortunately, we have time for only one last question. And there were so many wonderful questions here, and I apologize to those we didn't get to, but there were a number that asked the same question. So I'm just going to throw this out to you. How can people get involved? As a person, faith community, or a partner organization?
Well, our organization is always looking for folks to get involved. Mm-hmm. And if you wanted to be involved, right, we even put literature on the table back there. You could pick up. We'd like to have volunteers. We'd like to have any resources if you have deep pockets. if you'd like to go with us to Sacramento when we lobby, we take groups of people. And we certainly have a lot of information with books to study. And if you're a member of any congregation, we can give you information to help your congregation get involved and then inform all the folks that belong to that.
And the only thing I would add to that is if you're a member of a congregation, if you give Susan and Sarah your information, we'll call your clergy person and, you know, encourage them to get involved, especially if it's, you know, we can use your name that you wanted us to call.
Also, there are a lot of organizations in the Bay Area, and you can find one close to you. Like I said, ACTERRA and Hidden Villa are just two of them that I'm involved with, but they always need volunteers and people to get involved. And just an internet search of the, if I search green Muslims or green or environmental Islam, I come up with all sorts of websites that have tabs on what you can do and how you can get involved. So,
as I came in the door today, I saw big solutions for big problems. I can't think of three other people that I'd want to be sitting in the room with to help conquer these problems, because you are out there fighting the good fight. And I want to say a very special thank you to the Reverend Canon Sally Bingham, Rabbi Marv Goodman, and Sumbul Ali Karam Ali for their comments about interfaith ecological stewardship and responsibility. Let's have a big round of applause for them.
Thank you.
We also want to thank our audiences here and those listening to the recording and on the internet. Now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 113 years of enlightened discussions, is adjourned.